Highways and Byways. 1. There was a weekly newspaper in Chester's Mill called The Democrat, which was misinformation, since ownership and management, both hats worn by the formidable Julia Shumway, was Republican to the core. The masthead looked like this: The Chester's Mill Democrat, established 1890, serving the little town that looks like a boot. But the motto was misinformation, too. Chester's Mill didn't look like a boot. It looked like a kid's athletic sock so filthy it was able to stand up on its own. Although touched by the much larger and more prosperous Castle Rock to the southwest, the heel of the sock, the mill was actually surrounded by four towns larger in area but smaller in population. Motton to the south and southeast, Harlow to the east and northeast, the unincorporated TR-90 to the north, and Tarker's Mills to the west. Chester's and Tarker's were sometimes known as the Twin Mills, and between them, in the days when central and western Maine textile mills were running full bore, had turned Presteel Stream into a polluted and fishless sump that changed color almost daily and according to location. In those days, you could start out by canoe in Tarker's running on green water and be on bright yellow by the time you crossed out of Chester's Mill and into Motton. Plus, if your canoe was made of wood, the paint might be gone below the waterline. But the last of those profitable pollution factories had closed in 1979. The weird colors had left the Presteel, and the fish had returned, although whether or not they were fit for human consumption remained a matter of debate. The Democrat voted aye. The town's population was seasonal. Between Memorial Day and Labor Day, it was close to 15,000. The rest of the year, it was just a tad over or under two, depending on the balance of births and deaths at Catherine Russell, which was considered to be the best hospital north of Lewiston. If you asked the summer people how many roads led in and out of the mill, most would say there were two: Route 117, which led to Norway, South Paris, and Route 119, which went through downtown Castle Rock on its way to Lewiston. Residents of 10 years or so could have named at least eight more, all two-lane blacktop, from the Black Ridge and deep-cut roads that went into Harlow to the Pretty Valley Road, yes, just as pretty as its name, that wound north into TR-90. Residents of 30 years or more, if given time to mull it over, perhaps in the back room of Brownie's store where there was still a wood stove, could have named another dozen, with names both sacred, God Creek Road, and profane, Little Bitch Road, noted on local survey maps with nothing but a number. The oldest resident of Chester's Mill on what came to be known as Dome Day was Clayton Brassey. He was also the oldest resident of Castle County and thus holder of the Boston Post cane. Unfortunately, he no longer knew what a Boston Post cane was, or even precisely who he was. He sometimes mistook his great-great-granddaughter, Nell, for his wife, who was 40 years dead, and the Democrat had stopped doing its yearly oldest resident interview with him 3 years previous. On the last occasion, when asked for the secret of his longevity, Clayton had responded, "Where's my Christing dinner?" Senility had begun to creep up shortly after his 100th birthday. On this October 21st, he was 105. He had once been a fine Finnish carpenter specializing in dressers, banisters, and moldings. His specialties in these latter days included eating jello pudding without getting it up his nose, and occasionally making it to the toilet before releasing half a dozen blood-streaked pebbles into the commode. But in his prime, around the age of 85, say, he could have named almost all the roads leading in and out of Chester's Mill, and the total would have been 34. Most were dirt, many were forgotten, and almost all of the forgotten ones wound through deep tangles of second-growth forest owned by Diamond Match, Continental Paper Company, and American Timber. And shortly before noon on Dome Day, every one of them snapped closed. 2. On most of these roads, there was nothing so spectacular as the explosion of the Seneca 5 and the ensuing pulp truck disaster. But there was trouble. Of course there was. If the equivalent of an invisible stone wall suddenly goes up around an entire town, there is bound to be trouble. At the same exact moment the woodchuck fell in two pieces, a scarecrow did the same in Eddie Chalmers's pumpkin field, not far from Pretty Valley Road. The Scarecrow stood directly on the town line dividing the mill from TR-90. Its divided stance had always amused Eddie, who called his bird frightener the Scarecrow without a country. Mr. Swack, for short. Half of Mr. Swack fell in the mill. The other half fell on the TR, as the locals would have put it. Seconds later, a flight of crows bound for Eddie's pumpkins, the crows had never been afraid of Mr. Swack, struck something where nothing had ever been before. Most broke their necks and fell in black clumps on Pretty Valley Road and the fields on both sides. Birds everywhere, on both sides of the dome, crashed and fell dead. Their bodies would be one of the ways the new barrier was eventually delineated. On God Creek Road, Bob Rue had been digging potatoes. He came in for lunch, more commonly known as dinner in those parts, sitting astride his old Deere tractor and listening to his brand new iPod, a gift from his wife on what would prove to be his final birthday. His house was only half a mile from the field he'd been digging, but unfortunately for him, the field was in Motton and the house was in Chester's Mill. He struck the barrier at 15 miles an hour while listening to James Blunt sing, "You're Beautiful." He had the loosest of grips on the tractor's steering wheel because he could see the road all the way to his house and there was nothing on it. So when his tractor came to a smash halt, the potato digger rising up behind and then crashing back down, Bob was flung forward over the engine block and directly into the dome. His iPod exploded in the wide front pocket of his bib overalls, but he never felt it. He broke his neck and fractured his skull on the nothing he collided with and died in the dirt shortly thereafter by one tall wheel of his tractor, which was still idling. Nothing, you know, runs like a deer. 3. At no point did the Motton Road actually run through Motton. It ran just inside the Chester's Mill town line. Here were new residential homes, in an area that had been called East Chester since 1975 or so. The owners were 30 and 40-somethings who commuted to Lewiston, Auburn, where they worked for good wages, mostly in white-collar jobs. All of these homes were in the mill, but many of their backyards were in Motton. This was the case with Jack and Myra Evans' home at 379 Motton Road. Myra had a vegetable garden behind their house, and although most of the goodies had been harvested, there were still a few fat Blue Hubbard squashes beyond the remaining and badly rotted pumpkins. She was reaching for one of these when the dome came down, and although her knees were in Chester's Mill, she happened to be reaching for a Blue Hubbard that was growing a foot or so across the Motton line. She didn't cry out because there was no pain. Not at first. It was too quick and sharp and clean for that. Jack Evans was in the kitchen, whipping eggs for a noontime frittata. LCD sound system was playing, North American scum. And Jack was singing along when a small voice spoke his name from behind him. He didn't at first recognize the voice as belonging to his wife of 14 years. It sounded like the voice of a child. But when he turned, he saw it was indeed Myra. She was standing inside the doorway, holding her right arm across her middle. She had tracked mud onto the floor, which was very unlike her. Usually she took her garden shoes off on the stoop. Her left hand, clad in a filthy gardening glove, was cradling her right hand, and red stuff was running through the muddy fingers. At first he thought, cranberry juice, but only for a second. It was blood. Jack dropped the bowl he'd been holding. It shattered on the floor. Myra said his name again in that same tiny, trembling child voice. "What happened, Myra? What happened to you?"
"I had an accident," she said, and showed him her right hand.
Only there was no muddy right gardening glove to match the left one and no right hand. Only a spouting stump. She gave him a weak smile and said,
"Whoops."
Her eyes rolled up to whites. The crotch of her gardening jeans darkened as her urine let go. Then her knees also let go, and she went down. The blood gushing from her raw wrist, an anatomy lesson cutaway, mixed with the eggy batter splattered across the floor. When Jack dropped to his knees beside her, a shard from the bowl jabbed deep into his knee. He hardly noticed, although he would limp on that leg for the rest of his life. He seized her arm and squeezed.
The terrible blood gush from her wrist slowed, but didn't stop. He tore his belt free of its loops and noosed it around her lower forearm. That did the job, but he couldn't notch the belt tight. The loop was far beyond the buckle.
Christ, he told the empty kitchen. Christ!
It was darker than it had been, he realized. The power had gone out. He could hear the computer in the study chiming its distress call. LCD sound system was okay because the little boombox on the counter was battery-powered. Not that Jack cared any longer. He'd lost his taste for techno. So much blood. So much. Questions about how she'd lost her hand left his mind. He had more immediate concerns. He couldn't let go of the belt tourniquet to get to the phone. She'd start to bleed again, and she might already be close to bleeding out. She would have to go with him. He tried pulling her by her shirt, but first it yanked out of her pants, and then the collar started to choke her. He heard her breathing turn harsh. So he wrapped a hand in her long brown hair and hauled her to the phone, caveman style. It was a cell, and it worked. He dialed 911, and 911 was busy.
It can't be,
he shouted to the empty kitchen, where the lights were now out, although from the boombox the band played on.
911 cannot be fucking busy.
He punched redial.
Busy.
He sat in the kitchen with his back propped up against the counter, holding the tourniquet as tightly as he could, staring at the blood and the batter on the floor, periodically hitting redial on the phone, always getting the same stupid duh, duh, duh. Something blew up not too far distant, but he barely heard it over the music, which was really cranked. And he never heard the Seneca explosion at all. He wanted to turn the music off, but in order to reach the boombox, he would have to lift Myra, lift her, or let go of the belt for 2 or 3 seconds. He didn't want to do either one. So he sat there, and North American scum gave way to someone great, and someone great gave way to all my friends, and after a few more songs, finally the CD, which was called Sound of Silver, ended. When it did, when there was silence except for police sirens in the distance and the endlessly chiming computer closer by, Jack realized that his wife was no longer breathing. But I was going to make lunch, he thought. A nice lunch. One you wouldn't be ashamed of inviting Martha Stewart to. Sitting against the counter, still holding the belt, opening his fingers again would prove exquisitely painful. The lower right leg of his own pants darkening with blood from his lacerated knee. Jack Evans cradled his wife's head against his chest and began to weep. 4. Not too far away, on an abandoned woods road not even old Clay Brassy would have remembered, a deer was foraging tender shoots at the edge of Presteel Marsh. Her neck happened to be stretched across the Motton town line, and when the dome dropped, her head tumbled off. It was severed so neatly that the deed might have been done with a guillotine blade. 5. We have toured the sock shape that is Chester's Mill and arrived back at Route 119. And, thanks to the magic of narration, not an instant has passed since the 60-ish fellow from the Toyota slammed face-first into something invisible, but very hard, and broke his nose. He's sitting up and staring at Dale Barbara in utter bewilderment. A seagull, probably on its daily commute from the tasty buffet at the Motton Town dump to the only slightly less tasty one at the Chester's Mill landfill, drops like a stone and thumps down not 3 feet from the 60-ish fellow's sea dog's baseball cap, which he picks up, brushes off, and puts back on. Both men look up at where the bird came from and see one more incomprehensible thing in a day that will turn out to be full of them. 6. Barbie's first thought was that he was looking at an afterimage from the exploding plane. The way you sometimes see a big blue floating dot after someone triggers a flash camera close to your face. Only this wasn't a dot, it wasn't blue, and instead of floating along when he looked in a different direction, in this case at his new acquaintance, the smudge hanging in the air stayed exactly where it was. Sea Dogs was looking up and rubbing his eyes. He seemed to have forgotten about his broken nose, swelling lips, and bleeding forehead. He got to his feet, almost losing his balance because he was craning his neck so severely.
"What's that?" he said. "What the hell is that, mister?"
A big black smear, candle flame-shaped, if you really used your imagination, discolored the blue sky.
Is it a cloud?
Sea Dogs asked. His doubtful tone suggested he already knew it wasn't.
Barbie said, I think...
He really didn't want to hear himself say this. I think it's where the plane hit.
Say what?
Sea Dogs asked, but before Barbie could reply, a good-sized grackle swooped 50 feet overhead. It struck nothing, nothing they could see at any rate, and dropped not far from the gull. Sea Dog said,
Did you see that?
Barbie nodded, then pointed to the patch of burning hay to his left. It, and the two or three patches on the right side of the road, were sending up thick columns of black smoke to join the smoke rising from the pieces of the dismembered Seneca. But the fire wasn't going far. There had been heavy rain the day before, and the hay was still damp. Lucky thing, or there would have been grass fires racing away in both directions.
Do you see that? Barbie asked Sea Dogs. I'll be dipped in shit, Sea Dog said after taking a good long look.
The fire had burned a patch of ground about 60 feet square, moving forward until it was almost opposite the place where Barbie and Sea Dogs were facing one another, and there it spread, west to the edge of the highway, east into some small dairy farmer's 4 acres of grazeland, not raggedly, not the way grass fires normally advance, with the fire a bit ahead in one place and falling a little behind somewhere else, but as if on a straight edge. Another gull came flying toward them, this one bound for Motton rather than the mill.
Look out, Sea Dog said. Wear that bird.
Maybe it'll be okay, Barbie said, looking up and shading his eyes. Maybe whatever it is only stops them if they're coming from the south. Judging by yonder busted plane, I doubt that, Sea Dog said. He spoke in the musing tones of a man who is deeply perplexed. The outbound gull struck the barrier and fell directly into the largest chunk of the burning plane.
Stops them both ways, Sea Dog said.
He spoke in the tone of a man who has gotten confirmation of a strongly held but previously unproved conviction.
It's some kind of force field, like in a Star Trek movie.
Trek, Barbie said.
Huh?
Oh, shit, Barbie said. He was looking over Sea Dog's shoulder.
Huh?
Sea Dogs looked over his own shoulder.
Blue fuck.
A pulp truck was coming. A big one, loaded well past the legal weight limit with huge logs. It was also rolling well above the legal limit. Barbie tried to calculate what the stopping speed on such a behemoth might be and couldn't even guess. Sea Dogs sprinted for his Toyota, which he'd left parked askew on the highway's broken white line. The guy behind the wheel of the pulper, maybe high on pills, maybe smoked up on meth, maybe just young, in a big hurry and feeling immortal, saw him and laid on his horn. He wasn't slowing.
Fuck me sideways,
Sea Dogs cried as he threw himself behind the wheel. He keyed the engine and backed the Toyota out of the road with the driver's door flapping. The little SUV thumped into the ditch with its square nose canted up to the sky. Sea Dogs was out the next moment. He stumbled, landed on one knee, and then took off running into the field. Barbie, thinking of the plane and the birds, thinking of that weird black smutch that might have been the plane's point of impact, also ran into the grazeland, at first sprinting through low, unenthusiastic flames and sending up puffs of black ash. He saw a man's sneaker. It was too big to be a woman's, with the man's foot still in it. Pilot, he thought. And then, I have to stop running around like this.
You idiot, slow down, Sea Dogs cried at the pulp truck in a thin, panicky voice.
But it was too late for such instructions. Barbie, looking back over his shoulder, helpless not to, thought the pulp wrangler might have tried to brake at the last minute. He probably saw the wreckage of the plane. In any case, it wasn't enough. He struck the Motton side of the dome at 60 or a little more, carrying a log load of almost 40,000 pounds. The cab disintegrated as it stopped cold. The overloaded carrier, a prisoner of physics, continued forward. The fuel tanks were driven under the logs, shredding and sparking. When they exploded, the load was already airborne, flipping over where the cab, now a green metal accordion, had been. The logs sprayed forward and upward, struck the invisible barrier, and rebounded in all directions. Fire and black smoke boiled upward in a thick plume. There was a terrific thud that rolled across the day like a boulder. Then the logs were raining back down on the Motton side, landing on the road and the surrounding fields like enormous jackstraws. One struck the roof of Sea Dog's SUV and smashed it flat, spilling the windshield onto the hood in a spray of diamond crumbles. Another landed right in front of Sea Dog's himself. Barbie stopped running and only stared. Sea Dogs got to his feet, fell down, grasped the log that had almost smashed out his life, and got up again. He stood swaying and wild-eyed. Barbie started toward him, and after 12 steps ran into something that felt like a brick wall. He staggered backward and felt warmth cascade from his nose and over his lips. He wiped away a palm load of blood, looked at it unbelievingly, and then smeared it on his shirt. Now cars were coming from both directions, Motton and Chester's Mill. Three running figures, as yet still small, were cutting across the grazeland from a farmhouse at the other end. Several of the cars were honking their horns, as if that would somehow solve all problems. The first car to arrive on the Motton side pulled over to the shoulder well back from the burning truck. Two women got out and gawked at the column of smoke and fire, shading their eyes. 7.
Fuck, Sea Dog said. He spoke in a small, breathless voice.
He approached Barbie through the field, cutting a prudent east-tending diagonal away from the blazing pyre. The trucker might have been overloaded and moving too fast, Barbie thought, but at least he was getting a Viking funeral.
Did you see where that one log landed? I was almost killed, squashed like a bug. Do you have a cell phone?
Barbie had to raise his voice to be heard over the furiously burning pulper.
In my truck, Sea Dog said. I'll try for it if you want.
No, wait, Barbie said. He realized, with sudden relief, that all this could be a dream. The irrational kind, where riding your bicycle underwater or talking of your sex life in some language you never studied seems normal. The first person to arrive on his side of the barrier was a chubby guy driving an old GMC pickup. Barbie recognized him from Sweetbriar Rose. Ernie Calvert, the previous manager of Food City, now retired. Ernie was staring at the burning clutter on the road with wide eyes, but he had his cell phone in his hand and was ratchet-jawing into it. Barbie could hardly hear him over the roar of the burning pulp truck, but he made out, "Looks like a bad one," and figured Ernie was talking to the police, or the fire department. If it was the FD, Barbie hoped it was the one in Castle Rock. There were two engines in the tidy little Chester's Mill fire barn, but Barbie had an idea that if they showed up here, the most they'd be able to do was douse a grass fire that was going to putter out on its own before much longer. The burning pulp truck was close, but Barbie didn't think they'd be able to get to it. It's a dream, he told himself. If you keep telling yourself that, you'll be able to operate. The two women on the Motton side had been joined by half a dozen men, also shading their eyes. Cars were now parked on both shoulders. More people were getting out and joining the crowd. The same thing was happening on Barbie's side. It was as if a couple of dueling flea markets, both full of juicy bargains, had opened up out here, one on the Motton side of the town line, one on the Chester's Mill side. The trio from the farm arrived, a farmer and his teenage sons. The boys were running easily, the farmer red-faced and panting.
Holy shit, the older boy said, and his father whapped him backside of the head.
The boy didn't seem to notice. His eyes were bugging. The younger boy reached out his hand, and when the older boy took it, the younger boy started to cry.
What happened
here? The farmer asked Barbie, pausing to whoop in a big, deep breath between happened and here. Barbie ignored him. He advanced slowly towards Sea Dogs with his right hand held out in a stop gesture. Without speaking, Sea Dogs did the same. As Barbie approached the place where he knew the barrier to be, he had only to look at that peculiar straight edge of burnt ground. He slowed down. He had already whammed his face. He didn't want to do it again. Suddenly, he was swept by horripilation. The goosebumps swept up from his ankles all the way to the nape of his neck, where the hair stirred and tried to lift. His balls tingled like tuning forks, and for a moment there was a sour, metallic taste in his mouth. 5 feet away from him, 5 feet in closing, Sea Dog's already wide eyes widened some more.
Did you feel that?
Yes, Barbie said, but it's gone now. You?
Gone,
Sea Dog's agreed. Their outstretched hands did not quite meet, and Barbie again thought of a pane of glass. Putting your inside hand up against the hand of some outside friend, the fingers together, but not touching. He pulled his hand back. It was the one he'd used to wipe his bloody nose, and he saw the red shapes of his own fingers hanging on thin air. As he watched, the blood began to bead, just as it would on glass.
Holy God, what does it mean?
Sea Dogs whispered. Barbie had no answer. Before he could say anything, Ernie Calvert tapped him on the back.
I called the cops, he said. They're coming, but no one answers at the fire department. I got a recording telling me to call Castle Rock.
Okay, do that, Barbie said. Then another bird dropped about 20 feet away, falling into the farmer's graze land and disappearing. Seeing it brought a new idea into Barbie's mind, possibly sparked by the time he'd spent toting a gun on the other side of the world. But first, I think you better call the Air National Guard up in Bangor. Ernie gaped at him.
The Guard?
They're the only ones who can institute a no-fly zone over Chester's Mill, Barbie said. And I think they better do it right away.